Vayishlach is really an embarrassment of riches. But what I want to do with this morning's shiur is take a look both at this week's parsha and simultaneously look at last week's parsha. We're going to look at Esav and look at Lavan, the two primary villains that Yaakov really deals with in his life. You know, there's really a third major villain that Yaakov deals with, to some degree at least, and that is Shechem and Hamor. Later on in this week's parsha, and there's what to say about that. We're going to keep the focus narrowed on these two. These are definitely the two people we look to towards all time. Esav Sone Es Yaakov, the all-time battle between the forces of Esav, the forces of Yaakov, the forces of Yaakov, and the forces of Edom. Lavan, of course, we've every Haggadah, right? We begin with Arami Ovid Avi. We know that Lavan was not just somebody who tried to cheat Yaakov in the moment, but who tried to wipe out Yaakov for all time. So, yeah, Yaakov begins his first message to Esav by telling him, "Im Lavan Garti, I survived with Lavan, and now if I can handle him, now I'm coming to face you." So, you know, he goes like straight from the frying pan into the fire between the two of them this week. But I want to show that definitely the Pesukim, and for sure Chazal, and I think Rashi as well, see an important relationship between these two personalities. In many ways, they're like parallel but opposite at the same time, and that's going to play a very important role into how Rashi is going to deal with both of them, and how the Halacha is going to deal with both of them for all time. So, let's begin by taking a look at source number one, right? The legendary pasuk, the moment of truth. Finally, after the whole buildup, Yaakov and Esav finally meet, and the Torah tells us this amazing event where, despite the 20 years of hatred that Esav has nursed for Yaakov and the army that he's marching upon Yaakov with, so vayaretz Esav likraso, Esav runs towards him, vayichabekeyu, he hugs Yaakov, vayipol tzavarav, he falls on his neck, vayishakeyu, he kisses him, vayivku, and they weep. If you open up Nachama Leibovitz's Yunim in Sefer Bereishis, so one of the more modern Mefarshim who she quotes points out that we do have a number of times in the Chumash where we see a meeting between people and there's a hug and maybe a kiss, right? Any examples we could think of a meeting we could think
Yosef
of?
And Yaakov.
Yosef and Yaakov is one, right?
Lavan
and Yaakov. Lavan and Yaakov is one. Rachel and Yaakov is another, right? So we've had a few of these in Sefer Bereishis. Binyamin and Yosef are going to have that later on, and probably the most Moshe and Aaron. Moshe and Aaron meet in the beginning of Parshas Shemot. We know that there could have been tension in that moment, but because of the humility of Moshe Rabbeinu and the magnanimity of Aaron Cohen, there's not, right? That's the moment where after all the brotherly struggles we had in Sefer Bereishis, we have this unbelievable joining of forces of Moshe and Aaron and Sefer Shemos. But she quotes, I forget who it was, but she quotes somebody who points out that none of those meetings have anything like the emotion which is described right here with Yaakov and Esav. You do not have running and hugging and falling on the neck and kissing and weeping, which is astonishing if you think about it, right? You look at the level of the pshat, and Esav seems to exhibit more love for Yaakov Avinu than Aaron HaKohen exhibits for Moshe Rabbeinu, than Yosef HaTzadik exhibits for Yaakov Avinu and for his brother Binyamin, right? So that's kind of surprising if we stop for a second. But of course, what is the classic idea, you know, without looking at the show, what is the famous Rashi? What does Rashi say about the dots? Look at this Rashi. What does Rashi say about the dots on the word that he kissed him?
He
wanted to bite his neck. Right? He wanted to bite his neck. The pasta comes with dots on every single one of the six letters. So, of course, everyone knows the Rashi who says that he wasn't trying to kiss him, he was trying to bite him. Okay, so here's the twist. It's not a Rashi. Rashi does not quote the Medrash. And as we'll see, Rashi goes out of his way not to quote this Medrash, that Esav tried to bit Yaakov and tried to bite Yaakov, and we're going to try to figure out why, at least one profound reason why that may be. It's all over the Midrashim, and you have to try hard not to. The Radak, for example, right here on the 1a, so he brings it for us. He brings us the Bereishis Rabbah, who has two different views. They're both absolutely essential. So let's read the Radak. He says, in Bereishis Rabbah, Amar Rishon ben Elazar, b'chol makom sh'ata motzi ksav, Rabba al Hanakuda, whenever you find more letters than dots, ata doresh es aksav. So then when you darshan it, you're supposed to focus on the letters. Makes sense that there are more letters. That's what gets the focus of your drasha. Second line, nekuda rabba laksav. If the word has more dots than letters, ata doresh es hanekuda. Then you have to darshan focusing on the dots. Here we have a unique case, though. The dots and the letters are equal. There are six letters and there are six dots. So a dot on every single letter. So what does that mean? So he says, Kan lo aksav rabba v'lo nekuda rabba. Melamed shenashko b'chol libo. It means he kissed him with his entire heart. In other words, the dots are just there for emphasis. The dots aren't there to change the meaning of the word. The dots are there. It's a way of just bold. You know, it was like you read the Chumash, and as it were, the word vayishakeyu would be bolded.
If dots.
What?
You have seven dots.
So there one dot is the shin. One dot is the dot on the shin. So the Sorry, I was trying. I spent a little while trying to fix that, but then it was like very late. So yeah, there's one dot per letter. So Rav Shimon Elazar is telling us that that it just means you bold. You know, if you look, you know, if you see in the Gemara sometimes, you know, the Gemara sometimes will have a simon, and then we'll have a couple, a few words, and there's a random apostrophe in every single word that's there. So until recently, when you could just bold a text, what they would do to emphasize bold would be put apostrophes. That's a way of accentuating the text. So Rav Shimon Elazar is saying, yeah, before apostrophes, what our Masorah, the original Masorah, was to put dots on the letters. That's all. So it means he hugged him, he ran to him, and he really kissed him. That's you number one. And then viewer and doer, Rihanna doesn't buy it. Imkain lama nakod alav. It's an interesting question. He says, why are there dots on it at all? Well, there are dots. He just told you why there are dots. But apparently Rihanna thinks that from the pshat and the pasuk, you could tell that it's a very enthusiastic kiss. As we said before, this is described with more emotion than anything else in the Chumash. You don't need the dots if you just want to tell me it's an emotional moment, argues Rabbi Yanai. And therefore, he says, El Malamed, Shelo Bikish Lenashko. He didn't want to kiss him. Ela Lenashko. He wanted to bite him. Note, by the way, how in Hebrew, Lenashek and Lenashek, very, very similar words, right? Very, very similar words to kiss and to bite. When it happened, Vinasu Shinav Shel Shava, his teeth turned into wax. Vitzavar Shel Yaakov Shayish, and Yaakov's neck turned into marble, and that was not a good dental day for Esav. Now that explains the next word, Vayivku. Why do they both cry? So says Rabbi Yanai, Zebachal Tzavara v'Zebachal Shinav. So Yaakov is crying because his neck is aching, and Esav is crying because his teeth are in a bad way. You look at the Balaturim. Balaturim has a very cool and classic forms gematria, right? Vayishakeyu. He kissed him. Begematria linoshcheyu. He kissed him to bite him. Okay, so it fits Esav's personality. This Medrasher seems to that there's the overwhelming love for Yaakov Avinu. It fits the explains why they're crying. It explains why he's biting. And yet, look at Rashi on source C. So Rashi quotes the pasuk Vaychabkeu that he hugged him. This Galgalu Rachamav, right? He was Esav was overwhelmed with mercy. Yaakov bows down as he approaches Esav. And so says Rashi, the reason why Esav hugged him is because the strategy worked. Esav is marching to kill him, but he's overwhelmed with mercy when he sees the submissive posture that Yaakov Avinu is exhibiting. The Ramban, by the way, explains what exactly was Yaakov doing. He wasn't just being nice in a vacuum. He was demonstrating to him, you are angry at me because you say that I stole the Bechorah. The bracha was that the other brother is going to serve you. Well, look, you know, dad may have given me the bracha, but in practice, who's serving whom? I'm the one sending you the gifts, and I'm the one bowing down. I'm the one describing myself as the Eved and you as the Adon. I'm serving you, so there's no need to be angry at me because you actually are the true recipient of the bracha. That's what the Ramban says, and that's what's going to help get Esav over his rage. But Rashi begins by saying it's a genuine hug. Then, when Rashi quotes Vayishakeyu, he kissed him. So look at the source he quotes. Yesh cholkim edavar. So Chazal argue about this. Bibraisa, that is for sure true. Disifri, the Braisa in the Sifri, the Medrash Halacha in Sefer Bamidbar. For whatever reason, Rashi feels like he is not going to quote the Brachos Rabbah, the local Medrash. He's not going to quote the Medrash Tanchuma, another local Medrash on Brachos. He's going to go all the way to the Sifri, to the Medrash Halacha and Sefer Bamidbar, to give us two different views about the kiss that Esav has for Yaakov, and neither option is the option of the biting. What are the two views that Rashi quotes? Yesh shedarshu nekuda zo lamar shelo nashko b'chol libo. So there are those who quoted this drasha to say, what's the point of the dots? He did not kiss him with his entire heart. So it was no biting. It wasn't. Esav wasn't able to muster the emotion of a full kiss. There's a little bit of a perfunctory kiss on the cheek, as it were. You know, it was the Hanukkah reunion. You know, with like the great aunt who the little kid hasn't met and knows that they're getting a pair of socks for Hanukkah and just has to do what their parents tell them, kind of kiss. But there's no biting. And then Rashi continues. Amar Shimon bar Yochai. Fascinating line. Halacha, it's a halacha. We know. We have an absolute mesorah. Biyadua, known for a fact. She'esav sone le'Yaakov. We know that for all time, Esav despises Yaakov. Ella, nebchu rachamav ba'osasha. His emotions were changed to mercy in that moment. V'nashko b'cholibo. And he kissed him with his entire heart. Just like the view of Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar in the Breishas Rabba quoted by the Radak. By the way, which of the two does it seem like Rashi prefers?
What do you mean?
Which of the two?
He quotes
a Yesha Darshu, and then it sounds like there's more emphasis on the view of Rav Shimon bar Yochai at the end. That matches up with the hug. Yeah. It matches up with the hug. So it sounds like Rashi is, A, refusing to cite. I'm telling you, you have to bend over backwards. If you're quoting Midrashim, you have to try hard. It's in Pirkei Rabbi Elazar, the Medrash Rabbah. It's all over Chazal. You know, you can look in the Ishei Tanakh from Ishei Chasida, all over there. He goes to the one place where he can dig up where that Medrash isn't quoted. Instead, Esav is either just a perfunctory kiss or, in his preferred approach, a genuine kiss. Now, what's not only kind of surprising with that, because everyone knows this is Rashi. It's the Rashi about the biting of the neck. Right? And then you look, it's actually not there in Rashi. There was an earlier episode where Yaakov met a relative, we mentioned it before, and the guy runs over to him, he hugs him and kisses him. It's strikingly parallel. That is the hug that Lavan has for Yaakov. Look at source number two. So when Lavan finds out that Yaakov shows up, so he's Yaakov ben Achoso, he's Yaakov the son of his sister. The Torah told us, Vayaretz likraso, he ran to greet him, the exact same as Esav. Vaychabeklo, he hugs him, basically the exact same as Esav. Vaynashaklo, and he kisses him, basically the exact same as Esav. He brings him to his house, and then they have a whole story. It seems like a lovely moment. What? Achnasas Orchem, Lavan is following the Mesorah of Avram Avinu. Achnasas Orchem, he takes him home, he brings him back to the house. What a nice, sweet moment. Of course, we know Rashi tells us there was absolutely nothing genuine whatsoever happening here from Lavan the deceiver, from Laman Haramai. What does Rashi say? He ran to greet him. Yeah, why did he run to greet him? It's not the way he saw dollar bills, right? He said, I remember the last time this happened when Eliezer showed up. He had lots of money. So he says, Kasavar Mamanuton. He's bringing money. He's bringing dollars. Then why does he hug Yaakov? Because he says, well, I don't see the gold and the jewels dangling from the camel. There is no camel. The man's on his own two feet. Oh, maybe, you know, his crime is up, and so he has the money hidden inside his clothes. So he gives him a hug, and while he does that, he does a subtle pat down, you know. So there's no money. Then it's interesting, you know, in most of the, apparently most of the Rashi manuscripts, it depends which Rashi you look up, the Toras Chaim points this out, but many Rashis do have this, and it certainly is in the Breishas Rabba. So why does he kiss Yaakov? Even the kiss, the Breishas Rabba says, was for a jewel. Yeah, exactly. Right. Maybe he has the money in his mouth. Maybe he has the money in his mouth. So Rashi has absolutely no problem with the idea that Lavan's hug for Yaakov is completely done with ulterior motives. That's absolutely what seems from the text like a nice moment is actually deception from day one. And so I'm going to put it on the table.
Because we met already Lavan in Toldo, so we know what kind of personality he was there. So maybe that's why Rashi is not giving him any benefit of doubt or anything good.
Fair. On the other hand, Esav has been nursing a grudge trying to murder his brother for 20 years. I mean, say for Bracious, you know, murdering brothers is not great. I mean, it's 20 years later and it's for a bracha. He wants to murder his brother. So it's not like Esav is depicted. Rashi, by the way, in general, Ben's any moment Rashi has where he can ding on Esav, he'll do it. He'll ding on Esav basically any chance he has, except for whatever reason, this one right here, he feels like he needs to run all the way in the opposite direction. So we have this parallel between the moment in the Psukim, this parallel between how Yaakov meets Lavan and Yaakov meets Esav. We have Midrashim available to read them in the exact same way, that each moment of hugging and kissing was done with subterfuge. And yet, Rashi avoids reading it that way when it comes to Esav, and he does not avoid reading it that way when it comes to Lavan. And we want to ask, I want to ask why. So there are a couple of them, Mepharshim, who pick up on this in the terms of some of the local words. So for example, the Peir Shaksav HaKabbalah points out, the words are not exactly the same. You know, when it's Esav, so it was Vaychab Kehu, he hugged him as one word, Vaisha Kehu, and he kissed him, as opposed to Vaychabek Lo, Vaynashek Lo, where the words are separate, and he says that implies there's some measure of distance. Okay, could be, you know, as I say, it could be. I don't know if that alone is going to do it for me. You know, also others point out there's the weeping involved over here. The weeping seems to imply a measure of genuineness, which you do not have with Lavan. Rav Hirsch, for example, points this out. He says you never tears mean this is genuine. Okay, you know, could be. On the other hand, Hollywood actors and actresses can fake tears if they need to, and Lavan, I'm sure, could act with the best of them. So I'm not sure that alone is going to do the job. So that's what I want to put out. And the solution, I think, begins by realizing that Esav and Lavan, despite being the two villains, and despite being the two people that Yaakov has to deal with as he comes into his own, the transformation from Yaakov Ishtam Yoshev O'alim to being Yisrael, the person of whom the Malach says, Kisarisam Elohim Emashim Atuchal, you can handle the Elohim, whether those mean the powerful or the angels that are opposed to you, and you can handle the mighty people who are arrayed against you. Yaakov can handle all comers once he graduates Lavan and Esav University. Well, the two of them have really diametrically opposed personalities and diametrically opposed value systems. Esav is somebody who the one thing we know about him is he literally wears his emotions on his sleeve. With Esav, what you see is what you get. They could tell Esav's personality from the second he comes out of the womb. Right? He comes out red of skin and all hairy. There's nothing hidden from Esav. He is somebody who's extremely emotionally volatile, and what you see with him is as what you get. The emotional volatility, you know, the Mepharshim point out, if we go through Esav's career, he has wild swings, right? Min ha-katzeh el ha-katzeh, and we can document at least three different examples of it. Wild, wild disparity. First one, we'll just look, our parsha right here. The Ramban's read of the story of Yaakov and Esav. So Ramban has a fantastic point. Yaakov sends his messengers to Esav, and Yaakov gives them a whole prepared speech. You know, here's like a diplomatic text, you know, to read out. We would have had the nice press conference with Esav on one hand and the ambassador of Yaakov on the other hand, and they'll go to the cameras and they would read it out, and hopefully things would calm down. Now, then the Malachim come back to Yaakov, and what do they tell him? Source number three, Vayeshuva Malachim el Yaakov Limor, Banu Malachicha el Esav, so we went to your brother, to Esav, V'gam Holech Likrasacha, he's coming towards you, V'arba Meos Yishimo, and he has 400 men. So the Ramban asks, that's it? Yeah. What else? What did Esav say? Did he say, you know, I'm coming to kill you? They apparently deduce that Esav is coming to kill. Now, it's not a very difficult deduction. You don't need Sherlock Holmes to figure out what Esav has in mind when he's marching towards you with 400 men. But where is the answer that Esav has to Yaakov's message? So says the Ramban, their answer, there was no answer. Why? Esav was so enraged with Yaakov, he wouldn't take the meeting. That's what Ramban says. The Malachim show up, and Esav won't meet with them. He says, I'm going to kill my brother. I don't care about those messengers. I'm ignoring whatever gifts he sends me. I'm out to kill him. The Ramban, one parak later, says this explains something very funny that Esav says when Esav and Yaakov finally meet. And so, yeah, Esav, they meet, they hug. And then Esav looks around and he's like, what is all this? Where'd all this sheep come from? Where are all these sheep come? What do you mean? You got the message. It's literally, Yaakov told you, I was with Lavan, I did very well, Baruch Hashem, I'm coming back and I'm sending you a gift. Esav should know exactly where all of Yaakov's wealth comes from, because Yaakov told him. So the Ramban says, you see, one parak ago, I was right. Esav was so enraged, he wouldn't even take the message. He wouldn't even answer the phone call before marching to destroy Yaakov. And then what happens? He sees Yaakov coming to submit to him. He sees him coming to bow down. And we go from 20 years of nursing a furious hatred. Maybe in our lives, you know, there's been like one moment where we were boiling over with rage at somebody. Esav manages to catch that moment of emotion in a bottle and hold on to it for 20 years straight. And then he sees Yaakov bowing down, and all of a sudden, it all disappears, and he runs towards Yaakov, and he hugs him, and he kisses him, showing emotion, as we said before, like nobody has ever shown before. It is a wild, wild swing of emotions. But we've seen this on display from Esav before. Well, how did this whole business start up in the first place? Because of the episode of the firstborn, the Bechorah. So Esav needs a bowl of soup. But, you know, the Torah didn't just tell us that Esav traded the bowl. He could have said, look, I'm in it for the short term. I'm not going to live long. What do I need an inheritance for? I'm somebody who hunts every day. I take my life into my hands every day. The actuaries tell me that there's absolutely no point in putting all my money in long-term investments. So go ahead, take it. That's all that Esav needed to say. That's all he needed to say. But the Torah doesn't tell us that he just said that. Of course, the Torah ends in source number 4. Vayivez Esav asa b'chora. There's no such thing as indifference. Esav doesn't do indifference. If he's not going to care about the birthright, he's going to despise the birthright. He loathes it. He looks at it like, you're somebody who cares about the law. Live for the moment. He has no patience. He has no absolute contempt for somebody who thinks in terms of b'chora. And what happens to Esav 2 prakim later? When he misses the brachos, he goes from despising the birthright to craving it more than anything else in the universe, to the extent that he goes from despising the birthright.
It's worth something.
It's worth enough to despise his brother for 20 years, right? It's enough to commit murder of his brother. A radical transformation. And then instead of Vayivez Esav Asa B'chora, instead of just despising the birthright, it's Vayistom Es Yaakov. Not even Vayisno, not even Sin'an, an even greater level of hatred. So he's here, and then he's there. Nothing moderate with Esav. A third example we could find is Esav's marital history. Esav marries 2 Canaanite women, you know. So emotional intelligence, not high on Esav's list of strengths, put it mildly. So then all of a sudden, he wakes up, right? It's like amazing. He wakes up in Perek Kaf Ches, and oh my gosh, you know, it seems like Yitzchak does not approve of my idol-worshipping Canaanite wives. I can tell that because he just sent Yaakov to Padan Aram to get a wife from Laban's family. So he doesn't even move, blink an eyelash. What does he do instantly? He runs off to Yishmael to marry one of Yishmael's daughters, right? Now, Rashi and the Ramban are both careful to point out that this is a classic example of failed tshuva, right? Because what doesn't he do?
He doesn't divorce
the other ones, exactly, right? You want to do tshuva, that means actually repairing what you did wrong. You know, when Yehuda is going to do tshuva in Sefer Bereishis, so he's going to repair what he does wrong, first with Tamar, and then he's going to save Binyamin from slavery, right? Exactly undoing what he was supposed to do with Yosef. So tshuva is not just feeling bad. Tshuva is actually trying to take the steps to undo what you did. Esav fails in that area, unsurprisingly. But once again, we have this just, blink of an eye, okay. You know, I didn't realize. I didn't realize that my father wants me to marry somebody from the family. So instantly, he goes to Yishmael to marry Yishmael's daughter. So he's somebody who is constantly wearing his emotions on his sleeve, as symbolized by literally his physical appearance. Lavan, on the other hand, right, is the exact opposite. He's the ultimate Lavan Haramai, or he's Lavan the deceiver. What you see with Esav is what you get, and what you see with Lavan is never. never what you get. Once again, right, from the first one. Now, this extends not only to Lavan's just infinite capacity for deception, but look at Lavan's emotional control. Lavan is in total control of his emotions. I would suggest like nobody else we ever meet in the Tanakh. When is it most difficult to maintain your composure? It's most difficult to retain your composure when the other guy is screaming blood red in your face. The other person is enraged at you. Every instinct you have is to get your blood moving quickly. And yet, Lavan, not once but twice, has Yaakov screaming at him in rage. And Lavan responds with just unbelievable coolness. He is as cool as a cucumber. Usually we say that as a positive trait. In this regard, it's not. So when's the first time we see this? In source number 7, at the beginning of their relationship, when Yaakov finds out that he married Leah, not Rachel, right? And he runs to Lavan, and he says, Mazo sasisali, what did you do to me? And you can imagine, Yaakov is not saying this, you know, with like a nice, calm presentation. What did you do to me, he says. Halo b'Rachel avadati imach. I worked for Rachel for 7 years. What did you do? The Lama Rimi Sani, why did you deceive me? Right? He's red in the face when he comes to Lavan. And Lavan, just with total aplomb, says back to him, Neymar Lavan, Lo Yasachim. That's not the way. He doesn't blink an eyelash. He doesn't raise his voice. He's absolutely calm. He's in total control of his emotions. That could be a strength. Unfortunately, Lavan uses it not for what the Rambam describes of just avoiding anger. He uses his emotional control to control the emotions and to manipulate others, right? But he's in the radical opposite of Esav. It's even more dramatic at the end of the Yaakov-Lavan relationship, when after, you know, 20 years of absorbing everything, finally Yaakov breaks, right? And finally Yaakov has the epic rant. When he at least is falsely accused of stealing the trefim, and he goes on and on and on, and it's one of the longest just monologues in the Chumash. You know, Menachem Rosenbaum pointed out to me, or to me, you know, the Mitocha Ohel books that YU put out, like their studies on the Parsha. So they have it's a blue book. They have Mitocha Ohel on the Parsha, and they have an essay in every single Parsha. The one on Parshas Vayetze has a very, very interesting essay from a professor, Ya'al Leibowitz, who suggests that the reason why Rachel stole the Trafim was because she knew exactly what was going to happen. She knows her father better than anybody, and she needs Yaakov to finally break with her father. She needs this to happen. So she's going to, you know, steal him, she's going to hide him, Lavan's going to come, and exactly as she anticipates, Yaakov is finally going to break, and after quietly absorbing everything that Yaakov took from Lavan for 20 years, we're going to get that closure where Yaakov can finally lay out, you know, air all of his grievances. That's a suggestion that she makes. And there's no question that Yaakov airs his grievances. I worked for 20 years. We never would have known. Right? Yaakov, the MS of Yaakov, the integrity of Yaakov, we would not know about it, so obviously, if not for the psukim right here, when Yaakov describes how he worked for 20 years, night and day, in the freezing cold, in the boiling heat, any sheep that was taken. Halacha says you have a p'tur of ones. You're exempted if there's nothing you could have done. Yaakov Avinu never availed himself of that p'tur. He paid Lavan back every single time. He went infinitely above and beyond his responsibilities. And yet, despite that, if not for Hashem protecting him, Lavan would have sent him away with nothing. Right. So what does Lavan just respond to him after that total rant? Where he's clearly in the wrong, right? He's falsely accused Yaakov. He knows full well he's cheated him time after time. What does Lavan just respond? It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. And Lavan, Vayomer Yaakov, Habanos Benosai, the daughters are mine, Habanim Banai, the sons are mine, Atzon Soni, the sheep are mine, V'chol Asher Ataro E Lihu. You know, you just described in graphic detail how much you worked for me for 20 years. You haven't earned a single thing. It all belongs to me. It's all the generosity. It's the generosity of Lavan to give you anything, right? And you can hear there's no anger. There's no you can see Lavan's face. You can see Lavan, Yaakov screaming at him, and Lavan is just sitting there. You know, the quiet. Are you done yet? Are you done yet? Okay, yeah. Okay, you finished. It's all mine. Have a nice day. Total, total control of his emotions. So in that vein, they are completely divergent personalities. Now, one way of kind of thinking of the fundamental flaw of Esav and Lavan is that Esav, what does Esav seem to despise more than anything in the world? So it's not what really gets Esav going. If we read the psukim carefully in source number 9, Esav despises trickery. He's somebody whose everything is out there. What you see is what you get. And in Esav's world, the worst thing for him is deception. Actually, Yitzchak tells Esav, "Ba'achicha bimirma, your brother came in deception and he stole your brother." And that is why Esav gives him the name. He says, "Oh, he's called Yaakov because he cheated me." He thinks of Yaakov as a cheater. Cheating, deception. With Esav, it's all up front. He despises deception. In other words, the problem with Esav is that Esav, we know, admires his he admires his father Yitzchak. The Ramban even points out, fascinatingly, that he obeys Yitzchak. Torah tells us in this parsha that Esav goes to Seir. Torah tells us in source number 11 that Esav leaves Eretz Canaan because of Yaakov. Why is he because of Yaakov? So the Ramban writes, yeah, because Esav knew that Yitzchak had bequeathed Eretz Yisrael to Yaakov Avinu. So if that's what Yitzchak said, his father has the right to divide the inheritance, and he does what he wants to do. Okay, so he gave it to him. That's okay. The giving of the land was not deception, by the way. Yitzchak gives Yaakov 2 brachos. There's a bracha of serving the brother. That's the first bracha. That's the one which Esav despises because it was given deceptively. That was supposed to be Yaakov's brother. You read the pesukim carefully, though, and Yitzchak all along planned on giving the berkas of Avraham, on giving the legacy of Eretz Yisrael to Yaakov Avinu. That was never, there was no deception involved in that one. Esav accepts that. If that's what Yitzchak wants to do, he's going to accept it. In other words, Yitzchak takes the quintessential personality of Yitzchak, which is the personality of din, right, of judgment, of gvura, of might, and he takes that to a radical degree, where din becomes perverted, it becomes extreme, it becomes devoid of any chesed whatsoever. So he can look and he can say for 20 years, my brother has cheated me, he must be punished. Now there is no, it's completely untempered. So untempered din becomes not din at all, right? It is not just to murder your brother because he stole your blessing. That is not a proportionate punishment for the crime. But that really is what Esav's personality is. Unadulterated, right, which becomes perverted din, perverted judgment. He looks at himself as a hyper-principled person. He never deceives anybody. If he could take a step back and look in the mirror, he would realize how radically unethical that becomes. But the real evil of Esav is the complete lack of chesed that he has. And you have somebody who has no chesed and also thinks, is also suffused with his own sense of moral superiority, and that is a very, very dangerous combination. We can look at any number of authoritarians who are able to do what they do because they're absolutely convinced that they are in the right, and anybody who's opposed against them is infinitely wrong and deserves whatever punishment can be thought of. Lavan, what's the first thing Lavan does? The first thing Lavan does is an act of chesed. First thing we see him do is invite Eliezer into the house. He's inviting Yaakov into the house. He's performing Hachanasas Orchim. The problem is that the chesed of Lavan is completely unconnected to any moral scruples. If you just take pure the idea of kindness, what if we had a world of kindness without any din whatsoever? You would produce Lavan Ha'arami, where in any disconnection with principles and rules and scruples, you're going to have somebody who is going to just end up using the means of chesed and rationalize doing whatever they want to further their own benefits. I'm giving. But it's only ultimately connected. There's no din. There's no judgment. There's no limitation involved with lava, right? And then the chesed becomes totally perverted as well. Instead of becoming something to benefit someone else, it becomes a tool that can be used to harm those against you. Just like Esav. Esav's commitment to his own din leads to his desire to destroy others. And Lavan is the exact same thing, going in the radically opposite, and taking chesed to dilute or to destroy any element of din in it, and you're going to get something completely perverted. And in that light, we can understand the different strategies that Yaakov Avinu exhibits when he's approaching each one of them. When Yaakov approaches Esav, right, who is the man of pure and therefore perverted judgment, what does he do? He overwhelms Esav with chesed. He gives and he gives and he gives and he gives and he gives. One group, another group, more sheep, more sheep, more sheep, more camels. He's just giving and giving, submitting and submitting. He's just showing generosity after generosity to Esav. Esav says, I don't want it, I don't need it. Yesh li rav, I am so wealthy. Torah says, vayiftzar bo. Yaakov insists, he goes over the top. Take, 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 take. He drowns Esav in chesed. And it works. Right? The strategy he has of submitting and submitting and giving to Esav, it works. He's able to handle Esav by conquering him with chesed. Now, Yaakov is a smart man. There's nobody who's more strategic than Yaakov. He realizes the volatility of Esav, as we described before. He can be loving and hugging me one day and out to kill me the next. So it is very prudent to do what I need to do to ensure that there's distance between us at the end of the meeting, which he also succeeds in creating. But he's able to handle Esav by sharing him with chesed. He takes the playbook of Avraham Avinu, in other words, right, and he uses it to defuse Esav. How does he handle Lavan? If you look carefully at what he does with Lavan, it's the exact opposite. With Lavan, there is no chesed, there is no ava. He is completely in the mode of Yitzhak Avinu. In fact, as we'll see, he really runs back the exact same playbook that Yitzhak ran in his one fight, I guess, with the Plishtim. Lavan proposes to Yaakov in source number 12, Lecha nichrasa bris aniva ata. Let us establish a covenant. Let's establish a covenant. Now, this puts Yaakov in the Masorah of three generations who are making covenants with their enemies. Avram makes a covenant with Avimelech, Yitzhak makes a covenant with Avimelech, and now, Yaakov, we have a proposal for a covenant with Lavan. If you look at sources 13 and 14, you'll see something very, very important. Source 13 is the bris that Avram makes with Avimelech. And what does the Torah tell us? Not once, but twice. Once in Pasuk Chav Zayin, the first Pasuk here, and another time in Pasuk Lamed Beis, the second Pasuk here. Vayechrasu, shenehem bris. They made a covenant. Okay, it makes sense. That should be there. If there's going to be a covenant, the Torah should tell us that they made a covenant. Vayechrasu bris. Here the Torah tells us not just once, but tells us twice. What's fascinating is in source 14, Avimelech comes to Yitzchak, and Yitzchak is much less friendly. Take a look on your own if you want. It's very, very important to understand the differences between Yitzchak and Avraham. It's really the one real window we have into Yitzchak's din, which corrects maybe some of the excessive chesed of Avraham. And Yitzchak has no patience for Avimelech. Avimelech walks in there, and immediately Yitzchak tells him, what are you doing here? Madua basa melai. This is not nice. He's not welcoming. He's principled. What are you doing here? You despise me. You sent me away from you. They say, well, we realized Hashem was with you. They use the name Yudke Vavke, which Avimelech never uses when he deals with Avraham, but apparently the principle of Yitzchak moves them. And then the Plishtim propose the Nichrasa Bris Imach. We want to make a bris with you. We propose the bris. Now, what do you not see in source 14, if you read it carefully? Yeah, you never actually see Vayichrasu Bris. You never see a bris. Yitzchak makes a meal for them. And then the next day, there's an oath, and Yitzchak sends them on their way. But the Torah is careful to tell us that there is no covenant. There may be an oath of, or you know, we're not going to harm each other, but there's nothing that the Torah describes as a bris. There's no relationship. There's no covenant. We know what a bris is. A bris is a relationship, right? It's a covenant for all time. A non-aggression agreement is not a bris. Right? What is that? The Mishnah Perkei Avos, Shali Shali V'Shalach Shalach. I stay on my side and you stay on your side. That's a divorce. That's not a relationship. Right? Avram enters a covenant. Yitzchak is offered a covenant and he says, bris is not the way it's going to be. We're not going to be allies. We're just going to agree to not be enemies. And that move, the Yitzchak move, is exactly what Yaakov Avinu does with Lavan. Yaakov gets the same offer on the table. Nechras abris. Let us make a covenant. You do not see Vayichras ubris. You do not see them make a covenant. And here it's even clearer, because what does Yaakov do? Yaakov does of his own initiative. He makes a pile of rocks. Right? What is the idea of the pile of rocks?
Border.
It's a border. You're going to stay over here. I'm going to stay over here. And we are never going to see each other again. And Yaakov holds strong. For some reason, the Torah has to tell us, right, that Yaakov calls the bris, calls the pile of rocks, Gal-Aid, right, the witness, the pile that's a witness. And Lavan calls it Yagar Sadusa, the Aramaic words for saying Gal-Aid. Why does the Torah have to tell us that? Why do we need the Aramaic translation? And Lavan says it first, right? Lavan says it's called Yagar Sadusa, and Yaakov says we're going to call it Gal-Aid. And who wins? In Pasuk Mem Ches, it's called Gal-Aid, right? So who cares if we're calling it in Hebrew or in Aramaic? Because that's the battle, right? I'm not giving in. You stay on your side, I stay on my side, and I am not going to concede. We're not even going to, and you're going to give in to me on what to call a pile of rocks. Yaakov gives Esav sheep, he gives him camels, he gives him everything. He can't even give to Lavan what name to call the pile of rocks, right? There is din over here. I am not giving you a thing. Lavan, you person of total devoid of din, the person who's devoid of din, and you look at Lavan, you see what happens when that's not there. You just get to deception and trickery. Nothing but din from Yaakov Avinu. Now, we see his day. He's not fighting him. He's not killing him, right? But there's no giving whatsoever. He's not even going to give him on the name of the place. We're going to call it Gal-Aid. And then Lavan says to him, why don't we take oaths? Right? Pasuk Nun Gimel, one of the great, great psukim, such a profound pasuk. Elokei Avraham ve'Elohei Nachor, proposes Lavan. Right? The gods of Lavan and of Nachor will judge between us. And what does Yaakov do? He's not going to swear in the name of Elohei Nachor. That's obvious. He's not going to swear in the name of idols. He doesn't swear in the name of Elokei Avraham either. What does he specifically swear in the name of? Pachad Yitzchak. Right, he's doing two things right there. Number one, because he's invoking the personality of his father, he's taking Yitzchak's playbook when dealing with Lavan. And number two, he's emphasizing we're not related anymore. Right, this is not the brothers Avraham and Nachor. I'm going to the next generation. We are now disconnected. And you know, we can go through it very quickly. But the idea that Yaakov is divorced from Lavan, there is a break over here, and not from Esav, is clearly communicated by the psukim. When Yaakov first meets Lavan, the Torah uses the word ach over and over and over again. Right? Just look for one example, the greatest example, there are others, in Pasuk Yud, the first Pasuk. When Yaakov saw Rachel, the daughter of Lavan, achi imo, the brother of his mother, and the sheep of Lavan, achi imo, the brother of his mother, He gives water to the sheep of Lavan, the brother of his mother. Three times in one pasuk, Torah has to call him not just Lavan, but Lavan achi imo, the brother of the mother, the brother of the mother. The psukim continue, and we have Yaakov calling himself the brother of the mother. We have Lavan calling Yaakov my brother, achi achi ata, you are my brother, says Lavan. That is the last time, the one time that Lavan calls Yaakov my brother, is the last time a relationship of brotherhood is ever mentioned. Once Lavan deceives Yaakov, they are never described as brothers anymore. But the Torah doesn't just do that. The Torah, when we have the divorce, uses brothers. Brothers appear all over the place in Parak Lamed Aleph. Lavan takes his brothers. Lavan attacks Yaakov with his brothers. And Rashi labors to point out that none of the times that brothers are involved, none of those times include a Lavan-Yaakov connection. So the Torah is flagging for us. They once were brothers, and now here, everyone is brothers. You have Yaakov and his children, all those brothers. Rashi says, Yaakov still has a relationship with some of Lavan's friends. The only people who do not have a brotherhood relationship are Lavan and Yaakov Avinu. That is done. That brotherhood, which was so emphasized at the beginning, is gone. And in stark contrast, when it comes to Yaakov and Esav, the Torah reminds us time after time that Yaakov and Esav are still brothers. Now, in one degree, that is critical of Esav, because despite being his brother, he's out to kill him. But at the same time, they still are brothers. And the last time we have this in the Torah is the halacha, which is recorded for us in source number 15 on page number 4. Lo sisa'ev adomi, do not despise the Edomite, ki achichahu. Esav is still your brother. That relationship still is there, and there are consequences of halacha lamaisa, right? The Jews cannot attack Edom when they are entering Eretz Yisrael, because Moshe tells them you have to respect the fact Hashem gave them this land. He is your brother. It is a complicated relationship, to put it mildly, but the brotherhood survives. So we have Yaakov sizing up Lavan and Esav, diametrically opposed personalities, both severely problematic. You go into any extreme and it's going to be a disaster. Yaakov, who is the combination of Avraham and Yitzchak, right? He is the Midah of Tiferes, is able to draw on both playbooks. He can draw on the Chesed playbook to correct Avraham. He can draw on the Din playbook to correct Lavan. And then what's so interesting is, in hindsight, which one of the two is more problematic? And the Torah's view clearly seems to be, we'd rather deal with the person who has principles, who has din, even though it is completely twisted. But if somebody has principles, you can deal with him. If somebody is a Lavan, if somebody's Lavan where it's deception, you can't. So Yaakov is complicated, but Esau is complicated, we can deal with him. Lavan, we can't. What's so interesting, by the way, we said a minute ago that Edom is the is still your brother. But Esav's progeny divides into two groups. One is Edom, about whom we are told, you may not fight him because he is your brother. What's the other major progeny of
Amalek?
Right? We have Amalek, who we are told we have to fight, of course, for all time. What does Amalek do? Vaizanev, karcha baderach. Amalek takes all of the murderous passion of Esav and deletes any of the moral scruples, right? Yeah, all of a sudden he's the terrorist, or he's the one who's going to attack from behind and attack the weak and the women and children. One thing to say about Esav, you know, Esav he attacks head on. You know, he has no problems attacking the soldiers as well. It's Amalek which loses the one redeeming virtue that Esav has, and so they kind of combine. They do combine the worst of Lavan and the worst of of Esav. The Abarbanel points out, he says, it's not a coincidence that at the end of Parashas Ki Tzeitze, when the Torah tells us to destroy Amalek, Zachor Asher Asher Asach Amalek, what was the Avera right before that? Not to have deceptive weights and measures. Abarbanel says, it's not a coincidence that those two are next to each other. Why? Says he doesn't spell out, but I think it's clear, because that idea of deception is what gets infiltrated into Amalek. And then we'll just close, right? We have the Netziv in source number 18, who says they weep. Why do they weep? He says, because Yaakov realized, right? There's a mutual love over here. And he says, V'chein l'darot, the same is true for generations. When Esav taps into that better potential they have, then we respond to them. Why did Rashi quote the Medrash about Lavan with the hugging, but not Esav? Because the way we reconstruct it doesn't fit the personalities. Lavan is the one who's going to hug you and kiss you because he's looking for jewels. That's what Rashi says. But Rashi says, I look at Esav, I reconstruct him. The one thing I can't say about him is that he's biting Yaakov to destroy his neck. Maybe he can't. It could be it was a perfunctory kiss. It could be it was a totally genuine kiss. But deception is not there in Esav. And if we have honesty, then whatever problematic midos there are, and they are extremely problematic, but if there is a piece of honesty you can find in someone, then there is hope in the long term. And it may be the very long term, right? May take thousands of years, but the Netziv says we always wait for it. If that one virtue is there, we say, no, he is still my brother. I'm not divorced from Lavan. I'm not divorced from Esav. I am divorced from Lavan, and I'm going to wait, and the moment that I see the potential for tshuva, I'm going to respond in kind. So those, I think, are the two opposite evils of Lavan and Esav, both severely problematic, but at the end of the day, one we can't deal with at all, the problem of dishonesty, and the problematic honest one we can work with.
Sure. Okay.
Why is it